Thank you, Brian. I just wanted to say that I'm a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild, and Heidi is the executive director, and if anybody's interested in the guild's activities or joining, they should see Heidi. Heidi, are we going to have questions and discussion now?
We have time for questions and answers, yes.
Why don't we do that for a little while, and then people can get out of here and listen to the debate if they want. So just some ground rules. I will take short comments or questions, and I'll call on people serially and not call on somebody twice until everybody's had a chance to talk, okay? So who would like to speak first? This gentleman here.
Has it been noted that the entire dueling, fencing team was on that flight?
Right.
And most of the young people?
Yes, the entire.
Has it been noted?
No, it wasn't, but thank you for raising that. The entire young Cuban fencing team was killed.
Yeah.
This fellow here.
Brian Becker, you were saying that the reason that that this policy persists under so many presidents, I know Clinton didn't distinguish himself either, is because they somehow want to hide the accomplishments and the possibilities that are Cuba, because it added to sheer loathing of communism. But isn't it more that it's just that the perfect storm of money and political influence by these fellows and Ross Lehtinen and these people that were exiled, they lost their country, they lost their sweet deal, and they are never going to get over it. And they have so much money, and they're so bitter that they are able to parlay this into a great game that's just going to keep this embargo going, no matter what the damn ideology.
Well, Brian and Wayne, why don't you both try to answer that?
Yeah, we may not have an identity of views on that, but we may too. We'll see in the course of the discussion. I think there is certainly a strong element in terms of determining U.S. policy based on the Miami-based right-wing Cuban community. That is a bloc, that is a lobby, that's not small, and it's certainly significant in terms of Florida politics and consequently in presidential politics. But the Cuban community has shifted a great deal. There's a great desire among younger Cubans for a lifting of the blockade, even on a non-ideological basis. And certainly, I think even Obama's capacity to suggest a temporary lifting or suspension of the blockade for 3 months, which he did recently in response to Gustav and Ike, was not simply principled politics or the beginning of a change of policy, but partly an attempt to get those younger Miami Cubans to vote for Obama in the coming election. But I think that it's important not to believe, I really strongly want to recommend people not think that the Miami Cubans are the determining factor for U.S. policy in terms of Cuba. They are a factor, just as the pro-Israeli lobby in the United States is a factor in terms of U.S. policy towards Israel in the Middle East. But the United States is an empire, and it's a capitalist empire, and it's an imperialist empire, and it doesn't let any single lobby determine its fundamental policies. There can be factional differences within the establishment, and they're jostling for position. There may be some who believe that it's time to lift the blockade, but they all agree that the Cuban Revolution should be brought down. There's no disagreement about that. There may be a difference of opinion about whether the blockade actually strengthens the position of the Cuban Communist Party, and lifting the blockade could be a better way of eliminating the influence of the Cuban Communist Party. But the goal in all cases will be to remove the Cuban Revolution and return it to a different social relation and political relationship with the United States. And let's not think that it's about the form of government. Like the United States government always says, Fidel is a dictator. The Cubans only have one party. They need multiple parties. I mean, the United States has supported many military dictatorships in Latin America and many other kinds of very dictatorial governments, and it didn't bother them. The difference in Cuba, the fundamental difference, isn't because the form of government is not to the liking of the U.S. It's because the social content of the government is based on a different class power, the power of working people and the peasants in Cuba who, like most of Latin America, can only have real justice in their lives by going in the socialist road. And that's why I think it's the anti-communism which is the fundamental feature of the policy, even still with those who are favor maybe a change of in lifting the blockade. Others, I'm sure, have a view.
Well, look, we get along fine with China. That's a communist country. We have full diplomatic and trade relations. I fought the Chinese in Korea. I'm delighted that we have good relations with China. There's no reason not to. We have perfectly normal diplomatic and trade relations with Vietnam. For God's sakes, a country where we fought a very bloody and divisive war, and yet we have good relations with them. That's a communist government ruled very much as the Cuban government is. I'm not sure that simply saying that because Cuba has a socialist system, we can't deal with them is enough of an explanation. I think it's more than that. You go back to early American leaders who said that Cuba inevitably would become a part of the Union. It would fall like a ripe fruit. I think it was John Quincy Adams who said, a ripe fruit into the lap of the Union. And there was this, I was in the State Department when, as Castro was coming to power, and there was this sense that Cubans should do what we wanted them to. All right for Castro to come to power, but then he had to, had to come up to Washington and talk to us and sort of see the way he should go. Well, he didn't do that. He told us to sit on it. And then we could just never forgive him for that. So I think it's that more than anything else. Castro has gone his own way. Cuba has gone its own way. He has defied us and jeered at us and got away with it. And there's nothing more likely to drive a superpower up the wall than that. So it's perhaps in time, Obama at least is saying that he's prepared to have a dialogue. First, of course, they must meet his precondition. They must release all political prisoners without any conditions. Well, they won't do that. They won't meet our preconditions. They've had their fill of that. We've told them a number of times, you do A, B, and C, and then we will do X, Y, and Z. And they've done A, B, and C, and we haven't done anything. We have not lived up to our promises, one of the reasons I left the Foreign Service. So it's a very complicated thing, but I think it does go back to that. Cuba's a little country. Henry Kissinger at one point, as Cuba was going into Africa and winning, Henry Kissinger said, that little country has no right to that kind of foreign policy. That little country, there's so much, so many quirks in our approach to Cuba. But perhaps we'll get over it. I just end by saying how disappointed I was. God, as Bill Clinton was running for the presidency, the Soviet Union had disappeared, the Cold War was over, Castro had stated that it was no longer the policy of Cuba to turn the Andes into the Sierra Maestra of Latin America. Cuba was no longer going to be trying to overthrow other governments. So surely we could now begin to move forward, have a new policy, and engage. And old Bill, we thought, seems like a reasonable guy. But then old Bill goes down to Miami, has dinner with the Cuban American National Foundation, comes out with a check for $175,000, and says he likes the Cuba policy just the way it is. This is the way to put the hammer to Fidel Castro. Maybe we've gotten over that. I don't know. But at some point, surely we'll be able to have a reasonable policy towards Cuba. I've been waiting 26 years, though.
I wanted to add one thing about the Cuban Americans in Miami and how they are used by this government, and how that confuses and deceives people. In 1982, the Reagan administration wanted a, quote, respectable lobby for its Cuban policy. And so they founded the Cuban American National Foundation, made up of the richest multimillionaires in Miami and New Jersey. And that, of course, became, with U.S. help, with congressional money back and forth, the National Endowment for Democracy giving them money and they giving congressional members money. And it's like an industry. They created this Cuban industry. And it's used for U.S. foreign policy. And it's very simple, in a way, to understand that. If you know that the Richard Allen and Ronald Reagan anointed Jorge Mascanosa to be the president of that outfit, that two other people were named also to be his confederates, but they dropped out because they hated taking the orders. They didn't like the kind of orders they got. Jorge Mascanosa was fine with those orders. And the Cuban American National Foundation is still the most influential of the organizations.
I have no, believe me, no affection for the Cuban American National Foundation at all. They sued me. And in the Miami court, they won, but I won on appeal. I didn't pay a penny. Ha ha. Didn't have a penny to pay. But the Cuban American National Foundation has changed. Yeah. Cuban American National Foundation is now for Obama. They had the meeting in Miami and had him down. They have members of the Cuban American National Foundation now running against the Diaz-Balart brothers, Joe Garcia, and what's the other guy's name? Rafael Martinez, I think. Anyway, it has changed. It has changed somewhat.
That might be the arm of another policy, though.
Oh, well, yeah.
Kevin, you had your hand up.
Just a question, Wade. When you said you were surprised by Brzezinski's turnaround, and it just occurs to me that Brzezinski is either written about, I'm not certain of this, but has written about or made reference to the transformation within the State Department that led to what was to become the Contras, both in Nicaragua, but primarily the big thrust was in Afghanistan. And that seems to be a kind of a conjunction time-wise. There was a transformation going on, a big shift away from any kind of hands-off policy to successful liberation struggles like in Angola, and I guess a concurrent kind of rising up in Afghanistan, in Nicaragua. Maybe it was all part of some kind of dynamic you weren't aware of.
Maybe so, but I wasn't, and it was a surprise. I mean, it came from out of nowhere at that point. You're right. Later on, we saw other shifts taking place.
Did anybody else want to? Way back there on the right.
I didn't really have a question, but I had a comment when somebody mentioned earlier that the United States was having the nerve and the gall to demand that the Cuban government release their political prisoners before the United States will talk to them. What about all the political prisoners in this country, including the political prisoners being held on the Cuban territory of Guantanamo?
No, that's different.
And all the people sitting in we just lost a comrade a week ago who was killed by the state of New York, and he died of pancreatic cancer because the state of New York ignored him for 3 months while he demanded medical care. And why? Because he was a political prisoner. So if the United States wants to tell any other country in the world to release their political prisoners, they better get off their ass and release the political prisoners that they're holding right here.
Don't hold your breath.
Oh, I'm not holding my breath. Okay.
Way in the back.
In 1977, I used to be a reporter for the New York Times, and I went down to Caracas and interviewed Luis Posada in a jail outside of Caracas, and I wrote about it. I've since testified before Congressman Delahunt's committee. I was with him for about 4 hours, and I tape recorded the whole interview. Basically, there was no question that I interviewed Orlando Bosch and Posada in the same jail. They both talked circles around things. bragged about how they had hatched the plans in a secret meeting in Dominican Republic. They didn't say, I went and planted the bombs and the planes, but, you know, I didn't ask them because I knew that they were in jail, and they were quite annoyed that they were in jail because they had a secret deal with the government of Venezuela that they were allowed to commit terrorist acts outside of Venezuela. And they were actually brought to Venezuela to quell a growing left-wing reformist group. A lot of Cubans were invited down there. So Posada offered me a Cuban cigar, and I took it. And we sat there and talked for 3 to 4 hours. It was these jails in Latin America, you can just walk in and walk around and talk to anyone you like. It's a really weird system. It's not like U.S. jail. I mean, I went into their room. They had a television set. They had a bar. They offered me scotch and whiskey. And they were living very, very well. And they were quite frank. And at one point there was a suggestion that they really didn't intend to kill all those people. They wanted to put the bomb on the plane when less people would be killed. But, you know, and they were very angry that the plane had gone off with all, that the plane, the bomb had gone off in the air. They wanted it to go off on the ground. But that's, later on, I wrote about this, and the Department of Homeland Security, when Posada was in El Paso, I volunteered my tapes. I'd actually given my tapes to the Justice Department, because I was working with a guy in the Justice Department who was very good, and he was fighting with the CIA, because he was trying to find the murderers of Letelier, and the CIA wasn't releasing the documents that he needed. And so when I finished my interview, like a fool, I wanted to be objective, I went to the U.S. Embassy, told them what I had, and I had these tapes. And then I called up the president of Venezuela and said I wanted to, hey, let me get your side of the story. And I didn't get anywhere with that, but immediately I called my friend in the Justice Department, and he said, you got these tapes? And I said, yes. And he said, let me find out. And he said, you are in great danger. The CIA and the DSEEP, the secret police of Venezuela, are planning to kill you and to arrest you, and you'll never be seen of it again. So leave. I was in the Anoko Hilton there. And I got out, and I, instead of trying to go to across the border there, I went to Isla de Margarita, which is a little holiday island off of Venezuela, and stayed there for about 10 days. It's a nice resort island. And then I used my, I changed my name in those ways. It was a lot easier to, I used my first name as my last name so they wouldn't appear on manifests, and got out of the country and eventually came back here. Anyway, recently, last year, the Department, when he was in El Paso, the Department of Homeland Security, I was contacted by an attorney for the Department of Homeland Security. They said, what do you got? And I said, well, I know that it's against the law for you to let anybody, terrorist, stay in this country. And this guy committed many, many acts of terrorism on tape for me. And I said, I'll be glad to give you the tapes. Normally, a lot of journalists don't want to release this information, but I was willing to. I mean, I have a different attitude than many journalists about this. And they said, hold on, we'll get back to you. I called a woman named Jo Ellen Artinger, who was an attorney at the Department of Homeland Security many times. She never called me back. She completely lost interest. She didn't want to see the tape. She didn't want a transcript or anything like that, and let the whole thing go.
What's your name?
My name is Blake Fleetwood.
Thank you very much for those comments.
That's online someplace. I've read that stuff that you wrote. You should give people how to get it. I don't remember.
Congressman Delahunt had some hearings.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And I testified before those hearings with the New York Times reporter who interviewed Posada, and he admitted lots of things to her. And I actually released the tapes to him, and I don't know, what he's done with those tapes. Although the government had it for 30 years.
What's his first name?
Blake. Ever since 1977, they managed to lose the first set. But Delahunt has a copy of the second set, which was he admitted being conspiring to set up bombs in airports. That he admitted.
It's 25 to 8, and this gentleman had his hand up for a while. So, can we just take one more question? Is that?
Can I say, how far did the Times go in that chronology in publishing how far you went, as far as calling out the State Department, never getting called back? Did the Times print that?
No.
Yeah.
How much of the story did you gather?
The story I gathered in 77. I tried to. Lately, and the New Yorker actually signed me to do a long piece, but they at the end they decided not to publish it. They paid me off, but they decided not to publish it.
More questions?
What was interesting was that they just refused to take
it off. All right, two more questions. You and you, and then we'll say goodnight, and you can come up and talk to people up here if you want. So go ahead. Yes.
I don't understand what you're saying.
He's skeptical about whether Obama's actually going to go ahead and lift the sanctions, given his track record.
No, I wouldn't expect Obama to lift the sanctions at all. Obama will lift the restrictions on Cuban American travel. We're going to try to force the issue and get a bill before the Congress, or get action before the Congress, to remove travel controls on all Americans. I mean, you know, for goodness sakes, we're all citizens. We have rights too. You can't just lift the restrictions on Cuban Americans and leave us to flounder. So we'll push for that, and otherwise, try through people we know in the Obama camp who don't necessarily agree with us, but try to push a policy of engagement. But Obama is not one who's going to, he's not going to do it. He'll have to be led to it. And we're not even sure that that we can lead him, but we're going to try.
Well, a few years ago in the 90s, both the House and the Congress, and the Senate, passed a bill to end the travel ban. And I think there was something about the embargo in that. But then Bush would have vetoed it. And so in conference committee, the whole issue disappeared mysteriously. I think with an Obama presidency and a Democratic House and Senate, that would not happen again. And I think if the House and Senate could get to the same place they were then, that Obama would not veto. That's I think, the difference that we can hope for.
One last comment, and then
I'm a reporter for the student paper here, actually. And I was going to ask you, what role can public tribunals and events like this have in moving towards justice for the people who died and the Italian tourists who died? If there's really, as you said, very little media coverage outside of certain alternative, I guess, papers.
Right.
Well, I think that if you look at the impact of grassroots social movements throughout the recent period, in other words, you don't have to go back to the Middle Ages or some other time. You can just look at our recent history, the history we all know about. This country changed it from a formal apartheid state to having the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, not because the politicians in Congress changed that much, but because people woke up. There was a civil rights revolution by the masses of people in this country, a grassroots mass movement. Workers got union rights the same way. The war in Vietnam ended because of the people. Every instance that you can show where there was an actual change, it came because of the people. Now you look around the room and say, well, the mass media is not here and there's not enough people here and, you know, all the things that people say to themselves. But the meetings that happened in the early days of the Vietnam War or the early days of the Civil Rights Movement or of the Union Rights Movement, they're no bigger. In other words, it's not about getting other people to do it. It's about what we do, what you do, what I do, what each of us does, how committed we are, how dedicated we are to using our own voices and our own capacity to become our own media, to spread the word, to know that we are the most powerful vehicle. And I think the American people, the people of the United States, if they start to see the truth about Cuba, understand what Posada is, understand the need and the capacity for a change, that can happen. You have to have some historical overarching view to not be caught up in what every time, at every moment, people say, why is there so much apathy? Why is there so much discouragement? Everybody has always said that, and yet great radical transformative change happens because we keep plugging, we keep doing it, we keep telling the truth, and then eventually people respond. And I certainly think that you can see in the United States there's a tremendous desire for change right now. It's manifested all over the place in different ways, but certainly we have to take advantage of it. Those of us who believe in solidarity with Cuba, to take advantage of that yearning for change, to build a movement that demands change, and by that method we can not only hold Posada accountable, Orlando Bosch accountable, the terrorists accountable, but actually awaken the American people to the prospects of a new way that this country should function.
That's a good note to end it on. Thank you, Wayne Smith, Brian Becker, Jane Franklin. Thank you, Heidi Bogosian and the National Lawyers Guild. And good night, everybody.
Thank you. It's so nice to see you.